Hey everyone, welcome back to the Blessed Child Podcast. This is your host, Renee. Today, I am going to release an episode. It's an interview with the notorious Teddy Hoes. He is an artist and writer based in Brooklyn, New York. He is an ex-Mooney activist who grew up in the Tarrytown community just north of New York City near the Moon family in the 80s and 90s. Before he moved to Seattle when he was just a teen. Teddy was a second-generation leader in Seattle in high school and then went on to do STF and attend the University of Bridgeport, where I met him for 2 years, before transferring to the School of Visual Arts in New York City. He now creates social media videos for TV networks career-wise, and his own art on the side is currently music. Teddy is most known for his whistleblower efforts on cults and the Unification Church, having appeared on Netflix Explained, A&E's Cults and Extreme Belief, and numerous podcasts while doing graphic design for the Falling Out podcast. Check out his link, teddyhoes.com/press.html. It's in the show notes. It is a very impressive page for all of Teddy's activist activities. So go check that out and enjoy listening to this episode. Here we go. Recently, I was contacted by the infamous Teddy Hoes, and I am so happy to have him here today. Teddy, we met decades ago now in Bridgeport, and you recently listened to the Bridgeport episodes. We've been kind of doing a saga on them. So I would be really happy to hear your perspective on that place and anything you'd like to talk about.
Hey, yeah. So it's good to see you. And first off, I'll say, like, you know, I'm loving the podcast. Like, you bring so much like insight and intelligence and compassion. And then when you talk about yourself and your experience, it's like, oh, that's where it comes from. Like, so much grit, you know? Wow. So I'm just saying, yeah, no, it's really cool. Because yeah, it's true. I met Renee when, let's see, I was going to University of Bridgeport. I started in 1998. So Renee was like, she was still almost like a toddler, pretty much. Like, you were how old? Well, no, you don't have to say.
No, it's cool. I was 7 when I first moved into the dorms there and met you.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I was staying at, there was one dorm building where the first floor was where like the New Eden, which is like the boarding school, high school for, you know, Unification Church kids. It was like for the bad kids or whatever. Their parents like sent them there. Actually, one of my best friends in the church growing up, his dad was the principal. So they had like on the top floor of that dorm building, you know, they had a few extra rooms. And then the rest of the dorm floors were like for the girls and the boys and everything who went to the school. And yeah, I just like, I got a room and all I had to do was like security at night, which is pretty much just sitting by the door and doing my homework or whatever. And that was how I paid rent. So yeah. There's so much to say about this, actually. I'll try to compact it or you can edit it or whatever. But I never even planned on going to Bridgeport, but I did STF. It's the program after high school where you are labor trafficked, basically. And right after I did that, I was in such a state of like confusion and disorientation. And then I was like, I don't know what to do. Oh, I should go to college somewhere. And this one friend of mine was like, hey, we should go to Bridgeport together. Like, you know, it'd be cool. And I was like, huh? And like my family had already kind of drifted away from the church. But he was so excited about it that he put the thought in my head and then I took it because, you know, my friend could hook me up with like a place to stay there and attend so I could save a lot of money. So it was kind of like a first step. I never planned to graduate, actually. But then that friend ended up not even going. And I was like, what the hell? But I did have other friends there. And again, it was, you know, I studied graphic design there for 2 years. So that's the long story of how I met Renee. She just happened to be there. Her family lived in the building, right?
Yeah, we lived on I think we moved around in that dorm for a little bit, but we finally ended up on the fourth floor on the top, mm-hmm. on the right wing. And yeah.
I remember I would see your dad in the kitchen and he would talk to me about stuff. He actually told me, like, the most distinct memory I have of him is he was like, you know, don't mix money and religion. Like, I invested, I think it was like $9,000 or something into like a church business. And when it you know, defaulted or when it fell through, you, I think there's some policy where you're supposed to get some money back or something as an investor. And he was like, they just bowed and said, thank you for your donation.
Oh, wow. You know? Yeah, we can talk about this. This was the real estate investment properties in Tarrytown, Irvington, New York. The church in the 70s or 80s told all the members, hey, invest your money. Like, we're going to build these townhouses. Yeah. I think it's, yeah, somewhere by the Belvedere property. So they built a few townhouses. And my dad invested like maybe 10. He told me it was 10 grand, but now these days he's saying it's 1 grand. He's like going back and forth between his investments. I don't know what it was, but if you heard 9 and I heard 10, I think he's minimizing now that he's older. trying to cope with the scam of the moons. But
oh my God, yeah.
But he did. Sure. He did tell me David Kim invested like 20 or 30K, and David Kim was a big leader back in the day. So, yeah. In the early 80s, they built these beautiful townhouses, and then Bo Hipok came, took over the project, and was like, "Okay, guys, thanks for your investment. This is officially a donation for Reverend Moon and the Providence, and you guys don't get jack shit." So those townhouses, I think, go for like $1 million now. And and I think they sold them, they flipped them. But either way, I mean, they were part of a huge Ponzi scheme in the 80s. So that was when my dad learned the lesson, don't mix money and religion. And yet he still did it, But I think that's part of the cognitive dissonance. And it's amazing that he told you that.
Yeah, you know, I think, I'll get back to this. Like, let me put a pin on this. I just want to say when I met you, like, and you were this kid, like you were like a really like enthusiastic kid. You were like, oh, check this out. And like, you would like grab me by the hand and like show me a drawing you did. And I was like, oh, you were so sweet. And I feel like people, I know some other kids like that. And like, I feel like that energy, like there, this one other artist I know, she's also a whistleblower. And I feel like it's because you were such resilient kids, and then that you detected more strongly that something's holding this back and oppressing me, you know? I mean, I think all the women who grew up in the church feel it, even if they're still in, they're probably negotiating with themselves why it's still a good thing, but really know it's messed up because it's super misogynistic. But anyway, that's kind of what I got out of that. It's like the most enthusiastic kids are the ones who are angriest about the church, because they're like, you know, I'm naturally this way and you're trying to stop that or control me, and that's messed up. So that's kind of my deduction. But that's just an observation I had. I just thought it'd be interesting if I talked about you as a kid and everyone's like, get to know the host, you know, before she really knew herself, you know?
Wow, that is so insightful. My memory of myself, I mean, I remember a lot of heartache and lonely times. So to bring back that memory of like being with, I do remember grabbing your hand. I loved you. I was like, Teddy Opa, like you were kind of legendary status because you weren't one of the NEA kids. You were you were beyond the NEA kids, and the NEA kids would actually pick on me and my brothers. They were relentless. So when I saw you, I was like, oh, somebody that's like Opa, safe.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we gave it back to him though. It was
the bad kid school. So it was like a penitentiary.
No, you're right. I'm hearing all these stories about the troubled teens industry, and it's throwing me back to NEA, like, oh, that's what that was. But it wasn't that. It was like there was overlaps with everybody sent their bad kids to Bridgeport. And yeah, it was really interesting. A lot of bullying, but a lot of chaos and fun and rebellion.
Mm-hmm. They made like funny home videos, like they made their own productions, and I don't know. And it was kind of like college. They like pranked each other like in college. Like I remember the girls, like they took red markers and colored their tampons and threw it up into the boys' bathroom. So like there's always those stories too.
That's pretty great.
I hear a lot of stories like that from the GOP general orientation program of Korea. This is where I think when you reach middle school, a lot of second generation went to Korea. I heard you guys say GOP a lot, and people are going to be like, they were in the GOP?
What? Yeah, I know.
So
funny. Anyway.
Yeah, I wonder if they named it based on that because of the
close. Yeah, you know, when I went to GOP and I came back to America and I heard about the GOP on Fox News, I was like, yeah, that's us. Like, so streamlined.
I know, it's like, it's hard to tell the difference.
Oh my God.
But yeah, no, yeah, there was that too. Did I cut you off? I forgot where we were.
No, not at all. Okay, so okay. I still have questions about you becoming a security guard of the dorm. We did talk about the investments that First Gen made for the Ponzi schemes that Bohepok ran. Bohepok is a very interesting figure. I should do like a whole episode on him.
He's the, like, another podcast called him the charismatic figure leader of the cult because he was the translator and Moon was like,
oh my God. I'm so glad you
Yeah, he had better pronunciation and he spoke with more firm authority. He had a deeper voice. So yeah.
Well, Bohepok was also KCIA, like Korean intelligence. And then he, yep. This was on Elgin's, just his last podcast, he did an interview and they were translating Moon's speech. It was so weird because like I could listen, I studied Korean a little bit and like all Moon said was da, 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 Kojima. Like saying somebody's a liar, like that's all he said. And then all of a sudden Bohepok goes on a rant like, you know, Jesus was supposed to get married and have children and then he failed his mission and now we have to restore Jesus. And I was like, no, Moon just called him a liar. Like, what did you just like Moon like didn't say all that stuff. And I was like, whoa, how much charismatic lip service did Bohepok actually deliver to make Moon's speech make sense?
Oh man. Yeah, that's funny. That's a really funny observation. Yeah. That's cool that you know Korean too.
Just a little bit.
You retain that. I know. I can read it and I know like a song or two.
Yeah, I just know he didn't like say all that. Yeah, Bohepok. So yeah, it makes me wonder like if it really was actually Bohepok's church and religion.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, that's kind of like in Wild Wild Country. Like it felt like it was really about the next in command, the defender of Osho, Sheila, who was like, you know, his secretary. She was the one who was like giving the hard line rules. And she was the one who attempted murder, you know, when someone was being disloyal or whatever, or tried to attempt like a coup within the group. And, you know, Osho was just all peaceful and like, hey, I'm cool, bro. Everyone should be making love. You know, that's how it seems. So that seems to be, yeah, a lot of, you know, there's that funny saying like, Jesus, save me from your followers. You know, it's like, yeah, it seems to be the second in command who's really, you know, because they don't have like a threshold of like how, you know, they're just trying to please, please, please. And there's no limit to that. So that's something I've noticed in these kind of like high demand groups. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring up that point. Like Moon, it is Moon, but it's the whole organization working together. And they would kind of play off each other, like to pull media off of them or pull political pressures off of them and kind of go back and forth with like, oh, no, he's in a lawsuit. No, it's him. He did it. Like he laundered that money. It's an interesting conglomerate of like who's really behind the power, behind the curtains.
Yeah, but to your point, yeah, definitely, you know, the Moons were absolutely sinister and vicious and violent. I mean, I grew up near them, so yeah, and you lived in Tarrytown for a while, so maybe you got a glimpse, but like, yeah, they, scary people, scary people.
Yeah, I just remember sneaking into Cookjin's music room in Tarrytown. Mm-hmm. He had that recording studio for his band.
Oh, Hyojin?
Was it Hyojin? Yeah, not Cookjin. It was Hyojin. That's right.
Yeah, Hyojin was the metalhead slash gun enthusiast slash abusive husband who had a book written about him. So
yeah. And now he's passed away. But yeah, no, I remember. Okay, so Tarrytown, their property there, they had the recording studio. There was a martial arts room, and then there was the tennis court behind it. And the pond was beautiful. And then
we're talking about the Belvedere property.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about the Belvedere property. And then Jesus's wife lived on that hill, like in that big house.
Really? She did? Like in that main white, like off-white house in
like,
the middle?
Yeah. When you first drive through the gates and go up the hill, there's that one house, like with the cul-de-sac. That's where Jesus.
Okay. The main house.
Yeah. Wow,
so, yeah. Because it felt like... I one of the perks of all this, you know, human trafficking money, which is awful, is that we had, nice church properties. So like we would just walk in and out of there. There's like this beautiful library in there and these like beautiful wooden like ornaments on the walls and, you know, just this incredible property. But, you know, that's what the whole Unification Church felt like. Even our house that we lived in was a church property in Tarrytown, which, you know, I lived in Tarrytown, New York until 92. So I was like 13 when I left. Yeah, it didn't feel like ours. It was like, no, this is just church housing. Like nothing belongs to you.
Yeah.
And no. it's kind of funny how like life imitates cults, like powerful cult, in that like now, like everything, like most computer programs and stuff are like subscription based, and you can't just buy it and own it anymore. And I'm just like, ooh, is this because like cults are penetrating our governments now and stuff? Anyway, I don't know. I'm getting kind of paranoid and weird. I mean, I don't seriously think that, but it is a way to make more money or something. I guess it proves that, you know, maybe it's all part of late stage capitalism, you know.
I feel like humankind, there's only so many ways to organize a massive amount of people. And so inevitably, everything starts mimicking each other, like anti-communism, communism, cults, capitalism, social, all of them, you know, they're all kind of shadows of each other. They're very similar because you have to organize a lot of people and it takes a lot of fictitious beliefs and systems of control. So I feel like maybe that's the obsession with cults, is that people want like a more clear cut black and white, like, okay, what do we avoid? Like, what do we not do? What are we doing wrong? How can we do it better?
Yeah. I feel like it's like mostly, I mean, the emphasis on like, oh, communism or any one philosophy, I think what makes those things bad, I mean, you know, aside from like clearly racist or hateful groups where, okay, that's clearly wrong. But any kind of philosophies that, you know, are inconclusive, or I think a lot of it has to do with who's leading it. And I think the person leading it is usually going to take the brand that is popular with the society. And they're going to be like, well, I'm for this, right, guys? And like, in order to kind of control them or to, you know, influence, for example, the LDP in Japan, the Liberal Democratic Party, is super far right. But because that's the party in power, the leaders have to say that that's what they're part of. You know, Abe was ultra nationalist. So like, anyway, we're going into
a lot of things God.
We can talk about here.
This is super interesting. Recently, the LDP, the Japanese LDP, like, what was it? The whole thing, they all resigned.
I've only been keeping up bits and pieces. I visited my family in Seattle the last week, so I haven't been keeping up as much.
Gotcha.
Well, kind of in like relaxed, don't think about this.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now. Well, but, yeah, it turns out most of the LDP has ties to the Unification Church. There's so much examination of the Unification Church going on in Japan at this time. And like, yeah, it's all going back to Kishi, Sasakawa, like these guys aren't named, but what is it? Kodama and Moon, the guys who established the World Anti-Communist League, who worked with United States government to develop like the LDP, essentially. Anyways, we don't have to talk about that. But one thing I was so pissed off about on TikTok this morning, somebody was like, Abe Shinzo was assassinated and here's the juice. And they were like, it's because Abe was going to release documents on aliens. Yeah. And I was like, God damn it.
I know. They just like take our algorithms. Like, conspiracy. This is what John Bornfeld like struggles with.
I was like, guys, the Moonies and UFO, like, yeah, they're similar, but they're not the same.
I know. It's like, come on. No, we're the children born into this. Let us speak. Like, we're not theorizing here. Like,
oh my God. This TikTok went viral. Everyone was like, oh my God, somebody who killed Abe? It was planned. It's the government. And like, it's like, no, it was a Moonie. Well,
it's not like that wasn't going to happen, right?
Someone
has to. But it sucks that it went viral. Oh, I read this morning in some tweets, there's some suspicion that NHK Studios, which is like, I think they're like the NBC of like Japan, not associated with them, just kind of as big. And like they are somehow involved with the Unification Church. Like they acknowledged like the anniversary of Moon's death on, you know, so there's some suspicion. And they also operate in the same building, I guess.
That's the one.
Office. Yeah. So yeah, Renee and I are getting a lot of Japanese like second generation tweets like tagged and everything in those because they know we're whistleblowers. So yeah. Google Translate. Yay.
Yeah. I should actually, me and Eldrin are going to do a breakdown on some of the translations just to get it
circulating
in American and English speaking news, because like I'm so done with people talking about UFOs and Shinzo Abe being so, like, there's just random conspiracies going on. I'm like, guys, there's evidence, just like search up the names, like the men. It's yeah, it's bad.
Okay,
that's a fun tangent. Yeah, let's go back to you in Bridgeport.
So something else I was going to bring up along the lines of, you know, your dad telling me about, you know, I regret investing in this church company. And you, again, he said religion and money doesn't mix. And so someone else who kind of told me that too was the principal of the New Eden Academy, Dr. Spurgeon, who, again, I was like best friends with his son growing up, who, you know, by this time he went to the Blessing and he was already out. He was dating someone else, you know, so I didn't see him much, actually. He was with his girlfriend most of the time. So I remember Dr. Spurgeon, the principal, his dad, was driving me somewhere. He was giving me a ride, I guess, somewhere on campus that I'd go. And he's like, and it seemed like he wanted to talk to me. And so he said, just out of the blue, like I didn't even prompt this or anything, he was like, always be financially independent, never rely on the church for your finances. You know, he just like straight up said that. And I like really respected him. Like, that's the thing. He's a really smart person, really intelligent people. Like all those books in the school library, apparently he read all of those. It's like, even they can be pulled into something, you know, if it's powerful enough and charismatic enough. And, you know, there's tried and tested methods of essentially, you know, indoctrinating people that are very powerful. So that's like beyond intelligence sometimes, you know, that's human experience. Anyway, yeah. So what I gathered was that, you know, I think because my family was of the first flock, my parents were of the first flock of Unification Church members in America, the 777 blessing, that's like one of the earlier mass weddings. You know, the earlier the mass wedding, the more you're respected your family was. So I'm like one of the youngest in my family. My oldest brother he just turned 50. Sorry, Dave. Anyway, but like, I think they felt like they could talk to me because like, I knew what was up. You know, I came from like a longer line of the Unification Church. And, you know, I think deep in a lot of these parents' hearts were like, you know, we know what's going on. And, if we could talk about it with someone, we would, but we got to save face in order to like maintain these resources for our children, you know, because like, if we don't have this, we're screwed. So I think a lot of them feel trapped, but they just go with it and they tell themselves, oh no, this is a good thing. This is a good thing. You know, it's something called betrayal blindness that I heard of recently in psychology. Like, even if you're betrayed, you learn to like, just go with it anyways, because you have to in order to survive. And that can become a pattern, you know, after you leave a cult that invites, you know, problematic or dysfunctional things into your life or people into your life. So that's something I'm always having to be conscious of. A big reason I wanted to speak on your podcast is to speak to the complexity, you know, like that it's not black and white. It's not, why didn't you just leave? It's like, oh, like, I can't stand that. I know Jen Chiavo also is like, she wrote a whole blog post about it that spells it out really well and answers that question really well. I think it's important for anyone to just like really speak to the complexity, so people have respect that, like, you know, this isn't just stupid people, you know, in this church or whatever. It's a very tried and tested method of manipulation and coercion, you know, that's very powerful and that anyone is susceptible to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that insight on these people are intelligent. Like, my dad's a doctor as well. And if anything, he was an idealist, and he had a chaotic life before meeting the church. And so the church offered a lot of structure, wide goal, an ideal of unification of the world. I mean, that was grand and bigger than themselves. To be part of it was powerful, even if they're suffering in it. They're going to shove that resentment down, because being robbed of your money sucks. And it sounds like Dr. Spurgeon experienced that too, but they kind of let it slip to you. My dad let it slip to me. They kind of were trying to educate and warn us, but also, like you said, maintain the investments that they had made already in the community. And yeah, these people aren't, they're not dumb. This is part of survival in a massive community. You just have to save face and go with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, like, that's why they recruit mostly on college campuses, because people are fresh out of the nest and like, they're insecure and they're like, I don't know what my future is going to be. I don't know if I'm going to get a job. And like, you know, so everyone's vulnerable and just like freshly on their own. So when someone comes and they're like, hey, come to our nice center and we'll feed you and friends, da, 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 like that's so hard to resist. Like I would totally fall for becoming a Mooney if I was like, knowing me and like if someone love bombed me like that, I could totally see myself falling into it. So yeah.
And these systematic organizations of like breakdown and re-education are called the Collegian Association for the Research of Principles, which is CARP, that is on campus of hundreds of universities, where they do just that. Come to our movie night. Come to our movie night and come sing karaoke with us. We're a great group of safe people. And then, you know, a couple weeks down the road, we have a mission for world peace and unification, you know, and then... And then Moon's Reverend
the Messiah.
And Moon's the Messiah.
Yeah. And also, I also want to say, speak to that by saying, like, I think everyone who's involved in that has good intentions, like, because they were so, you know, indoctrinated with like, this is a good thing. And they see good things and they hear all these holy speeches for hours and hours that make me want to kill myself. Anyway, it's like, they all think they're doing a good thing. And it's all backed by this human trafficking money that they don't question where it comes from. They're just like, wow, we have these beautiful properties and look, we all get along, we have jobs, and you know, and anyway, you just have to stick to the program to like survive it. So yeah, like I think everyone has good intentions in CARP. I don't think they're like out to be like, you know, we have to separate these people from their families, and like they really all think they're helping people. And that's, you know, I think ISIS and the Taliban, like they think they're helping people. They think they're ridding the world of evil people. Like that's what people need to understand. Like just, and I see that kind of happening in America with extremist groups. I think everyone wants to do the right thing, you know, but it's when you're not aware and you're just too, yeah, it's just when there's so much support and think linear thinking in like your group or whatever. Anyway. You get it.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of people were bringing parallels between Hitler and Moon recently. And like, I was looking up Hitler's ideology and like, he thought he was helping the human race as a species.
Oh yeah.
He wanted to create, the superhuman. He wanted.
Mein Kampf sounds like a biblical, like spiritual book.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he wanted to create the superhuman race, blue eyed, blonde haired. And he thought just, and this is the tie with Moon, is the blood lineage, the pure blood lineage would lead to heaven on earth or whatever he called it. And it was the Aryan race. And then I think Moon took that exact theology, pure blood lineage, but instead of physical blood lineage, it was spiritual blood lineage. And like, I can't unsee the similarities now between Hitler's ideology and Moon's. I'm like, oh, it's the same thing. There's this us versus them, this superiority complex, this pure blood lineage. Just, and you can do really awful things when you believe that you're so special and different. And I think that's maybe what is so damaging, is when you start viewing the world as us versus them. And then some benefits outweigh the risks or the damage. And that's when things can go really bad.
Yeah, I remember someone else said, like, it's like eugenics, like the whole pure blood thing. It kind of, it's that feels like eugenics, because it's like you're born into like being right, you know? Yeah, I was also going to say, like, that kind of also goes into my thing about like, oh, I don't think these like, you know, narcissistic leaders care about the philosophy of this or that. They just try to go with what people can relate to, or, you know, you have to kind of parlay off something else, like another trend. If you want to make your own thing, you can't just introduce something out of the blue and expect people to like accept it. Also, the concept of body thetans in Scientology is like exactly the same theory that they're using in Chumpyung, of like, you know, you have little tiny evil spirits, microscopic, like in your body, and you have to slap them out. Like that, I'm like, is the Unification Church just a big patchwork of plagiarism that wants to stay in power? It feels, it's like, oh, well, that worked for that cult, so I'm going to take that. You know, like, is it all that? Like, I can imagine, because the Moons are so sociopathic that, you know, there's no thought of what's right or wrong. It's just like, what's going to keep me in control? And based on what I'm hearing, like, especially like Tim Porter's episode in the Falling Out podcast. Yeah. Like, he talks about the moons and what he knows of them, because he's about the same age as like some of them. He's older. And yeah, the way he talks about them as people and interacting with them and hanging out with them is like, wow, you know, they're just like, it's about control. And if they lose control, they're going to like mess you up, or they're just going to get violent and nasty. Like, that's really, and it's sadly, I think that comes from trauma. You know, like, they, Moon wasn't a good father. He was a violent dad. He hit his kids and totally neglected them. And he would like tease them like toys. And then they treated church members like toys. They treated us second generation like toys. And that's why my older brother, my oldest brother, who also used to hang out with them because we grew up near them, he stopped wanting to hang out with them after like a few times. Like, they would do stuff like, you know, dunk their quote unquote friends' heads underwater until they almost drowned, and then just like pull them out and laugh, you know, like, that's kind of who these people are. And, you know, I appreciate the ones who have a few of them have stepped away, or the younger generations, I think, also have kind of stepped away from that whole moon craziness. But I, you know, I still think they need to go to a therapist and like unfuck all this, you know, crap. That's just like, in a nutshell, my assessment of the moon family. Yeah.
Did you hear about that time there was a moon, a true child and a regular second gen on a boat in a lake, and the kayak flipped over and one of the kids died and the moon kid lived?
Yeah. So someone I know like claims that Hyojin like held some like a second generation underwater, you know, again to like tease them, and then like held them under there too long. So it was actually like
a murder. Yeah. But
I don't think he intended to murder him, but yeah, that's the theory. And of course, you know, anytime there's a death, like, the church just covers it up. And then they're like, oh, well, if the person who died's closest people in their life says everything is, you know, explained, like, I'll just believe them.
Yeah.
You know? So
I was talking with one of my parents about that. My stepmom, and things didn't add up. So when you mentioned that they like to drown people for entertainment, that's the story that came to mind. I was like, oh, you know, that night, I don't think there was a lot of wind. It wasn't a storm. It wasn't anything crazy. Like, that kid could probably swim. It was a lot of weird things going on around the boat.
Yeah. And I'm sure Hyojin in his head, he was like, oh, I broke one of my toys.
Yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
That's honestly how I feel like. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awful.
But at the same time, I'm sorry, just to go back on this Hyojin thing.
Yeah.
Tim had in the Falling Out podcast, Tim had also talked about how, but Hyojin was like oddly like loyal to the people in his group. So like, Tim was in his little posse, you know, and like, if anyone messed with Tim, then Hyojin would like beat that person up. So it was really weird. Just to say, you don't know this person as one thing. Like, these are complex people too. Yeah.
I'm glad these actual stories are coming to light instead of, I mean, I revered the moon children growing up. I thought they were royalty. Mm-hmm. I would kiss the feet, you know, they threw clothes at us, Monte piled. I remember having a pair of socks like given to me during a morning service, like at 2 o'clock in the morning in Belvedere, and they were worn and they were used, but they were the true children's socks. And it was like, oh, wow, these are sacred.
Yeah, there's it's funny. So someone posted on this one online group, there's like a quarter of a bagel eaten by Sun Myung Moon on eBay for $100.
Oh my god.
From like 1998.
Jesus, I'm like, Christ.
Dude, you better put that in some casing.
Yeah.
But like, I think it wasn't just like Moon climbing the ladder. I mean, what I heard was that like Moon, when he convinced one of the top insurance companies in Korea, like the family that owned it, to like join the Unification Church. And so he had this incredible surplus of money all of a sudden. That's when it went next level to like mega international church. But I also heard that, I guess, Bohee Pak was, maybe he wasn't, or the KCIA, like they weren't in the church at the time, but they like plucked Moon from society and like, we're going to use this guy. Like, I guess it was kind of a two-way street. I don't know. It's really hard because, you know, none of this is documented accurately. because, you know, you can't ask them about it or they'll be like, God ordained this. And so you just have to like kind of rely on speculation and clues like around it. And I don't know if we'll ever have a totally clear story, but, you know, how well do you know your moon has documented all that stuff really well? Yeah.
There are names I'll drop: Bohi Pak, Wampil Kim, Yuna Kim, David Kim, and all those guys in like the 1950s. That's the connection between a lot of political pool that the moon organization has now. But what was I gonna say? Shoot, I totally forgot.
We're talking about the governments and like moon.
Okay. The ties with communism, how it parallels is like we were all working for free. Like you were trading your security job labor for a place to stay. My dad was working in the dorms, living off the compound, working as a physician and a teacher so we could stay there. And it's like a one bedroom, even there's no bathroom. There's a shared kitchen, a community kitchen. There were dorm rooms.
Yeah.
But I mean, I visited dorm rooms these days and they have their private bathrooms. Like they'll have two rooms attached with the bathroom. It's like, we didn't even have that.
Yeah. Yeah. The price of school has gone up so much that, oh my God, my nephew went to art school and man, it was like a luxury suite. I was like, dang, like he didn't mind that he was like going to school during the pandemic. Cause he's like, man, I got this suite apartment or like, sorry, dorm, but like, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, the dorm that we had was not the same. Gosh,
yeah, it really was like a prison. Like you could see like the brick walls, like it wasn't open face brick walls. It was like the cinder blocks that painted over in white that made up our wall, right?
Wow. Yeah. No, you're right. And then the bathrooms were so dingy and that elevator was so unsafe.
Oh, yeah. Wow. It's all coming back. Oh my God. That was, yeah. I can't believe I went there, but, you know, I don't know. The only good feeling I get is like, well, I was young then and like excited about life and I had more hair and I kind of skateboard and I don't know. And I was meeting other college kids and sometimes they would see me through the window doing security and I was like, hey, and I just had to explain like, well, you know, I'm not like really in the church, right guys? Like,
oh, wow.
I didn't have bad feelings about the church until I researched it more like in my early 30s. And then that sent me on this whole trail of becoming like a whistleblower more. But, you know, while I was in it, it was, you know, they cater to you very well. You're treated as special because you have the pure blood because you were born into the Moonies. And like, you know, you have this great international group of friends. I really liked that. I really feel like a citizen of the world. And so when we moved to Seattle when I was 13 and it was like, my school was almost exclusively white. Like I felt really like kind of limited. I was like, man, this is only like one perspective. Like, come on, like we need more voices. Anyway, I do appreciate a lot of stuff. And I think it's the members who make any cults good. They make it, you know, they have to clean up for the, you know, unpredictable cult leaders, like reckless narcissism, you know, who can be charismatic as at first, you know, just like getting into a relationship with an abusive boyfriend, you know, or girlfriend. Like, yeah, the introduction's always warm and fuzzy, but then, you know, then the rough stuff kicks in and you get traumatized into sticking with it. It's like, anyway, cults 101. But
wow. Yeah. Speaking about the grownups in Bridgeport, looking back, I can't help but have some sympathy for them, just how much they were kind of used and controlled. And
yeah, I think it's mixed. Like, I think but that's the thing. And then like in stuff like labor trafficking and stuff, they're all bonding experiences because you're all having a tough time together, which hardens the glue more to like stay in. And like, it's funny, like when I see online, like some second generation as adults, like, you know, it's sad, like when one of them dies or something, it's like, yeah, he was my brother during STF, you know, like we were selling like crazy, you know, like you were selling for fascism. That's what you were doing.
Like, man,
no. It's, but such, you didn't, a, know. Yeah. Nobody knew, but anyway.
It's such a mixed bag. It really, really is. God.
Yeah. But it goes to show that, you know, I think like the bottom line is like people will do what they have to for survival and acceptance and to be validated. Yeah, it's harder to see things all the way through, you know, like that's why this climate change thing is so hard, is because like it's just like, like the world is getting hotter, and I don't know, but it's so hard to change our systems and that we rely on, you know. It's like air conditioners contribute to like
the global warming,
climate change.
Yeah,
but, it's really hard.
We need a massive overhaul on green energy. Like we need a massive shift, and hopefully it's coming. Hopefully it's coming. You know,
I mean, the hotter it gets, the more I think people be like, oh, okay, like it's not real until it happens to me, right?
120 degrees in Europe this year, maybe 130 degrees next year. Maybe that'll do it.
Yeah. Or like that one meeting in Venice where like it was about climate change and stuff and how like the water levels were rising, and then water came into the meeting room. They all had to clear out. Yeah.
It's ridiculously dry. Like I think it's rained like maybe once every 6 months down here in West Texas. Maybe.
Yeah.
Because we keep putting the water into the ground for oil. Like I'll have to go show you guys some of the water pits, but they're putting it in by the lake full to get oil out. Millions and millions of gallons.
Wow. Yeah. I went back and visited last year the house I grew up in Tarrytown from like, you know, the mid 80s to the early 90s. And there was a pond by that house, and that pond is like maybe a third of it is left. It's all dried up. So that was also like, but anyway, I'm not a scientist. I don't want to attribute to climate change. I don't know if that's the reason, but it just was like, ooh, like this clear thing from my childhood that changed.
Yeah,
like,
no.
Whatever it was.
We all have eyes for observation. Like if you see water going under into the ground, disappearing forever, like below the water table, and then it's drier, like, you know, there's got to be some cause and effect there. But anyways, this is, we'll go away from that. Okay. So I kind of want to talk to you about SCF. Okay. So your family drifted away from the church, but you went to SCF.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in 92, we moved to Seattle, and well, Bellevue, Washington was just outside Seattle. I don't know why. It's like the, you know, if you're from the Bay Area, it's like the Palo Alto of San Francisco, or it's like the Beverly Hills. It's just like the rich kind of, you know, white collar place. It's almost like a whole nother city where a lot of people get tech jobs and stuff now. And Redmond nearby is where Microsoft is. So we moved to Seattle, and in that time, it's funny because, and Elgin has talked about this too on his podcast, it's like Moon messed up in that he had parents, you know, have their families move to their father's hometown. And, in order to witness to that town, because I guess he was losing members or whatever, I don't know, just spread the witnessing effort. And a lot of these families who left the headquarters in New York, you know, to go to these states and countries, suddenly realized they were away from someone looking over their shoulder. And so my parents just like slowly drifted away, because I think there was just such a sea change of like the pressure in New York and like the stuff they were involved with. I think they really started to see it from a distance for what it was. And I think they knew the money was going to like messed up places and to people's luxuries. So anyway, it looks like you're going to say something.
Can I just say one point about this is the home church, Providence. This happened right around the same time Moon was prosecuted for tax evasion in the Danbury prison. So it was very much to get the heat off of his organization from labor trafficking people for a decade in vans, 7-8 years in a van, and having everybody in the Manhattan Center. And like, it was just, it was too much attention. There was too much negative attention. So
I never thought about that.
Yes. So the political move was disperse, create families, get real quiet, lay low. Wow. And that's what happened. So I just wanted to put that in there. So continue.
And that was so hard too, just like leaving all like, you know, this community that, again, it's like the hardened glue of like feeling like you're rejected from society, especially growing up in like, you know, Tarrytown, New York, where the Moons lived, and feeling even more like everyone was looking at you like, are you involved with that family, that cult family nearby? You know, they were hyper. I mean, you experienced that too. So, moving away from that and having to enter the world was like really hard. And I don't think I'll ever come down from it. Like it was like being born on drugs, you know, it's like being born into this hyper accepting place, simultaneously being so detached and afraid of the world. And that's what I bring up a lot in my podcast interviews and stuff. I think that's the difference between my childhood and maybe others who lived maybe further out and were like, it wasn't as bad for me, or like, or it was worse in other ways, you know, I don't know. But living near the Moon family, I think, is definitely a distinguishing factor in my particular upbringing and why I feel even more compelled to speak out from a place of like experiencing direct interactions with these people. So anyway.
Ooh, I'm reading this book, Thought Reform by Robert J. Lifton. It's a great book, right? It's mm-hmm. great. That's where I got
it's intense. It's harsh.
It's so right. intense.
It's about trauma. So
yeah, this is the first book that I read that I was like, that was like Chung Kyung. And it's like he's talking about a communist yep. prison camp. And I'm like, wait, why do I relate to the prisoner? And I also yes. relate to the conditioning that that was done to them. I'm like, why is this? Why does uh-huh. this hit so hard?
To me, the key part was like where they had to listen to lectures of like the Chinese, you know, nationalist philosophies and stuff. And there were people with sticks who were poking them to stay awake. I'm like, that's exactly what they did at Camp Sunrise.
Yes, yes. And then the struggle, like you would be prosecuted by your whole team, your whole group of prisoners that would like prosecute you to re-educate you for your benefit. So you could be part of the people's, you know, group. And it was like, this is too much. This is exactly what we went through. Oh, I looked into the author, Robert J. Lifton. He actually mm-hmm. first intercepted Korean War vets, American POWs in South Korea in 1952, the same time Bo Hee Pak and Moon were all getting together. Mm. And so he studied these people. And I think that's when he started building a philosophy for thought reform and mind control, and like building, okay, you need sleep deprivation, you need food deprivation, you need re-education, you need breakdown, cult of confession. He wrote all of this down in that time period. And I like after reading this book, I'm like, did Moon and his intelligence operations like get a hold of these formulas? Because it's exactly the same. I'm sorry.
Oh, Oh, well, there has to have been some note taking from Mao, like absolutely.
Yeah, it's weird. But reading that book anyways, what you're telling me, it reminded me of one of the Chinese survivors that Robert J. Lifton interviewed. It was like he was born into a family, like an upper aristocratic family. He had so much pressure since a young age to lead, to be God's chosen person, to lead and to... Yeah, he just given a lot of power at a young age. It can be beneficial, but at the same time, he said that no child can leave or grow up from that amount of pressure and power unscathed. And yep. you were you had so much, especially being born close to the Moon family from an early couple. And you were, I mean, I looked up to you. I couldn't help it. You were one of the older second gen, one of the first older second gen that I met. And I did look at you special. And like, I feel like, yeah, that kind of responsibility at such a young age, you can't escape that without some type of hypervigilance or yeah, like damage, like you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, just, you know, talking with other people who grew up in the Moonies online, like it made me realize all that, like listening to their stories and even in podcasts and everything. Yeah, that it's, you know, the Unification Church is another society just like anyone else's. It's like there's the people who are respected, and like one second generation called my family the Kennedys of the Unification Church. It's kind of interesting. But yeah, like my parents were artists, and like I think they were kind of, it made them very charismatic for lectures, but it also made them like, in certain circles, they did say like they had problems with certain things. Or one kind of touching story is like, you know, they have the 8-day ceremony after a new child is born. This one family who lived in New York that they were, I guess, kind of close to, they bought their own property, like not within the Unification Church grid or like their cluster of properties. The father bought his own house. And because of that, you know, the Unification Church leadership, they said that his daughter was denied an 8-day ceremony. So my parents actually just had their own for him. So like, you know, that just goes to show, like, I do feel like there are those stories with our parents. And I wish that, you know, there was enough trust and like understanding of the complexity to be able to like talk about stuff like that. But there's just so much loaded, you know, stuff. And like, I think it's just really hard to talk with parents unless like you get one like alone, away from the church, or they're already questioning, like they have to be in a place where they can't like just cling on to like, you know, this identity or this group, or like this, if they keep going to church functions and they have to keep saving face or like keep those relationships up, you know, if you get one of them in like a place where they have to kind of speak for themselves and account for themselves, then I think, you know, I'm not pushing anyone to do that. That's really hard. I have a hard time doing that, even though my parents left, like they left in the 90s, but they're still very far right. And it's been really hard ever since Trump got elected, you know, and now that Biden's president, like, you know, it's not as bad, but it's still there. I think they're still in QAnon, you know, they get the QAnon Japan stuff, I believe. I don't know. I don't want to say anything definitive. They haven't talked too much about it, but there's been enough signs. But again, I like to speak to the complexity of things. I think in any good movie, good movies are not about like someone who chooses the right group to be in, and then like, you know, because they're in the right group, they win. No, good movies are about people in trying situations, problematic groups. You know, why do people like to watch things about cults? It's because how does a person interact with the system they're in, you know, as problematic as it can be and as oppressive, how do they personally win and like get through that? And that's kind of how I see people in the church, you know, certain parents or certain just members in general. It's like, this is the arena that we were given. And how do you deal with that? You know, so I don't like it when people are like, why don't you just leave? I mean, it's so much better everywhere else. It's like, yeah, but your brain has been so, you know, influenced to just live in this world and to see everything else as this cliff that you're jumping off.
You know, with everybody being in talking more, I'm hearing the question, why didn't you just leave less? Have you realized?
Oh, yeah.
You've noticed that?
In the media too.
Yeah. Starting to realize that. And I love that, because it's, yeah, if you're born in the water, you don't realize you're in water. You don't even know what air is. That's kind of what it was like being born in cult. Or if you were born into a family with, you know, domestic violence, that's normal. You don't know there's any other way. That's just normal. It's like,
yeah,
I think that dynamic is becoming common knowledge. It's like, I'm glad that all the activists, I just want to say thank you for, and Jen and all the other activists out there that are normalizing
it.
And thank you and myself that are, you know, I'm hearing that question less. So thank you for your work.
Yeah. But there are still some of those offshoots. There's like that one, I don't know, there's some brand, I think we talked about it once, it was called like the cult of clean or something. I forgot. I don't know the exact name, but they had this like funny culty commercial. It's like, when you join our cult, you get all these environmentally safe cleaning products. I'm like, I'm for the cause, but not the marketing. That's terrible. These are traumatized people. Like, do not mess with traumatized people and like their lives. Like what I always attribute it to make it like understandable to people is like, remember how we used to treat drug addicts like criminals and like monsters? Now we know that it's attached to things like mental illness, you know, addiction's a disease. And like, we try to be more understanding, you know, that's kind of where the cult members are, you know, it's like an addiction. And like, you know, it's something that created harm that they were not aware of, and they were just doing their best and they were trying to get through their day and everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And poking fun at cults for commercial is very disingenuous to survivors. It's very confusing. It's we already minimize what we've been through. So then seeing it on a commercial is like, oh yeah, it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, that's the worst.
It's awful. You just shove it back down. But yeah. Okay.
But I'll balance that with saying like, I've actually like in like a Facebook group, I mentioned to Paige Wesley, one of the hosts of Cult Podcast. Like, you know, that's a podcast hosted by comedians. So of course they joke about it and stuff, but they just do tons of research. And like, I feel like they joke about the right things and they get mad about, they do get mad where like, you know, it's important to get mad. I mean, there's a few parts where I'm like, okay, that's like a little too much, but I think like in general, like they do have the empathy enough, like to talk about it and be able to joke about certain things, you know, that members can laugh, you know, with. But yeah, you have to do like the crazy amount of research to have the like competence to be able to go there. I think they get that. And like, I really appreciate that. Yeah. So I guess I'll go back to this question from like an hour ago.
I have so many other questions, but yeah, let's do it. Oh my gosh.
So I did SCF. Like, I think what it was, okay, so we moved to Seattle in the early 90s, but, you know, and that whole time we were drifting away from the church. We stopped going to like the main church. We had our own little, like, you know, veteran older family members, because the older family members weren't going to that church anymore either. They're all like over it. They're like, those guys are all, they think the church is blah, 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 but we know how it really is and how it changed over the years. These are the old sages of the church from like the 777 blessing. But my sister did STF, you know, STF is again, the labor trafficking program. You live in a church center after college for a year, maybe more. And I think part of the reason she chose it is because she's like the only girl in my family. And I don't want to impose this on her. This is just my thoughts. But I thought, you know, my mom really overcompensates for my dad to the point where he wasn't even around, you know, for us growing up. He's not really, you know, I think he feels like he's doing good and everything. But I think, you know, one thing I call the Unification Church is the church of bad dads. It's very patriarchal. It's very misogynist, to where moms have to do everything, you know, at home. And like, you know, culturally, that's also a Japanese thing, but not to that extreme. And have to overcompensate for the dad who's like in other countries for months and doesn't raise the kid pretty much at all. So that's kind of how I felt like it happened to my family. Again, it's kind of widespread in the church. I know many other families like this, especially if they have an immigrant mom who moved to America for the church and doesn't really have a life outside of it locally. So like they're coerced to just be that identity and feel empowered and validated in that identity only, you know? And I feel really bad for my mom in that way. So she goes to the closest thing outside of it after the church was like Fox News and like, you know, far right propaganda. Anyway, so I feel like my sister was kind of imitating my mom and like feeling like she has to like save the family, you know? And like, I was the next one down from her. So she was always kind of my big sister. She was showing me stuff. She was almost like a second mom. And I know you have talked about in your podcast with other like women on the podcast about feeling like a mom to your brothers, you know, like the kid, children raising children, you know, that's like a thing in the church. So she was kind of like that with me too. And she got me to go to STF also, because I think we just weren't ready to leave and it's all we knew. And, you know, in any cult, I think you are taught to value the cult more than your individual family. You know, you're taught to value. And plus the cult is the provider. It's the one that plans events for you. It's the one that has these things where you have these friend get-togethers, you know, and the parents don't really have as much power over their kids like a normal family, because most families in the world, I guess I'll call them independent families, they don't have that. It's just the parents, you know, and maybe the next one up is the president, but there's no relationship or coercion there, like depending on what country you're in. So as, you know, Margaret Singer, noted cult scholar, put it, it's like parents are middle managers, you know, for the cult leader who is the be all end all for the kids. So, you know, it's like if parents are mad about their kids not respecting them, like really try and get perspective that way. You know, that's, and I'm not on one side or the other. First gen and second gen have like their gripes, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of frustration between them because of different viewpoints. But anyway, yeah.
Sorry, I just have to say, like, our parents were infantilized. Yeah, infantilized. Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah.
Because exactly. Even the lingo, true parents. Then what are your parents? They're children of true parents. And then what are we? We're all on the same level then. And so there's a lot of dodged responsibility within the family. There was a lot of kids raising kids. What's that called? Parentification.
Yeah.
So that's just with the rhetoric. And so it sounds like. And then also our moms were taken away by the church. So even though there's a church of bad dads, like it was a church of absent moms as well. So really, yeah. Really, where else did you have to go but STF? It was structure. Like, I don't remember having a 5-year goal besides getting blessed, because the church would come up with new missions every year, every like on the drop of a hat. So yeah, we lived really by like day to day, whatever the movement wanted to do. But sorry to cut you off. I thought that was important.
No, totally. And then I know a lot of second generations who go to the army, you know, for the same reason. It's like, they just crave structure. They're like, I don't know what to do, or like, you know, what, and it's hard. Like when you grow up in it, and it's almost like, yeah, now they have this thing called the 7-year course with Generation Peace Academy, GPA, which is, you know, almost the same thing as STF. And I think they want to stay in because, like, I remember after leaving STF and I was done with it, I was like, wait, now I have to like decide that what I want personally as an individual is going to lead the way for my career. Like, it's terrifying. I was like, dove into books and counselors. I was like, help, I got to figure me out and make money and survive based on what I want all of a sudden, which is something no one ever asked me or helped me develop.
That's overwhelming. Now. Yeah, that's overwhelming. Yeah. I want to just comment on the 7-year course. There's been some research by scholars in the church. I was reading up on CARP, and they targeted it initially. They were like, the best age group to recruit is 18 because that's the most active. You can have the most influence on their life course. Also, your brain's not as developed until you're 25. Your prefrontal cortex doesn't fully develop. So the 7-year course, I want to say, is based off of biology as well as mind control and thought reform, because from 18, when you go to STF, to 25, when you're doing your 7-year course, which is the designated course, you can form somebody for a lifetime to be a productive member of the Unification Church with the goal of world peace and unification. You can have them choose, you can choose their career for you. I mean, like, you know what I mean? So it's very smart. This isn't a dumb cult. This is a very, very smart, organized, systemic cult. And I felt the same way. Like, we were very much formed on our STF years to be very public thinking, never abuse public money, always do things for the service of others, and living for the sake of others. That was the rhetoric. So yeah, when you got out, I don't know. I remember having like a lot of panic when I got out of OLT, not knowing like if my decision to go to school for this was selfish, or if I was making the right choices to have a family. Like, what do you, like, I know you're a very active speaker. How has that influenced you?
When I think about, yeah, right after I left SDF, and that's a story in itself too. I've told this on some other podcasts, but like, my mom always, she was always really good about Christmas. Like, as the time the family got together is when my dad came home and stuff, you know, because honestly, I would only see my dad like 2 or 3 weeks out of the year when I was a little kid. So she wanted me to come back for Christmas. Like, I did a second year of STF just because I was like, again, like kind of peer pressured into it and avoiding.
Hey everyone. And that will wrap up part one with Teddy Hose, the Church of Bad Dads. This week is a very special week. I'm actually going to release 3 episodes. So you can go ahead and just listen to the part 2, Church of Bad Dads, that I am dropping right now. This week was very busy for me. I've been getting a lot of interviews, and one of them is time sensitive. So you're going to have a bonus episode sometime in the next few days. But everybody take care of your mental health. And we will talk again real soon. Just keep rolling. Here we go.